Good morning. We are so grateful to be here today, and my wife and I want to make it very clear, we are here to say thank you to you and not the other way around. This is from our perspective, that's why we're here, and I hope we'll have a good chance to say that to you during the potluck time. In the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we have many stories of Jesus performing miracles of healing. He heals people who have leprosy, he reverses paralysis, he restores the sight to the blind, he gives hearing to the deaf, he gives wholeness to shriveled limbs, he drives out demons from those demon-possessed, and he even restores life to those who have died, a young boy and a young girl at another time. In the Gospel of John, the writer John doesn't repeat any of those miracles that are found in the other three Gospels. Rather, he has his own set of miracle stories. In John 4, he tells about the dying son of a government worker that Jesus heals. Then we had the story that we read this morning, that Dan read this morning out of John 5, where Jesus heals the man who had been unable to walk for 38 years, and he heals him so he's able to walk. And in John 9, there is he's an adult man who was born blind, but Jesus gives him sight. And so he's able to see for the first time after he became an adult. And then finally in John 11, we find Jesus has a friend whose name is Lazarus, and Lazarus has died, and Jesus doesn't get to Bethany where Lazarus lives for 4 days. And so he comes on the fourth day and he asks the sister, Martha, to open the tomb, and she says, using her best King James English, she says, "By this time he stinketh." He's really dead. But Jesus said, "Lazarus, come forth," and he was raised from the dead. In most of the cases where we hear these healing stories, there's no indication that the infirmity was the result of sin. In fact, it's quite clear that in the case of the man born blind, it couldn't have been his sin that caused his blindness, for after all, he was born blind. He'd either had to sin in utero, or his parents would have sinned, or something else, but it couldn't have been his sin that was the cause of his blindness. However, in the story that we have in John 5 that Dan read for us this morning, this seems to be a kind of an exception to the story. Here, Jesus heals a man who had been lame for 38 years. Later, when Jesus finds him in the temple, he says to him, "Stop sinning, or something worse may happen to you." Based on the words of Jesus, I think it's reasonable for us to assume that this man had perhaps done some specific sin or had a settled disposition of sin within his soul that resulted in his physical malady that he was suffering from. Now, sin itself is a spiritual condition. It sometimes does have a physical effect. Some of us may have felt that, sin resulting in some sort of a physical effect. It isn't always the case. But what we do with our bodies is evidence of what is going on in the inside, in the inner man. When we choose to do something that is evil or sinful, when we steal, kill, or destroy in some way, we are actually giving evidence to what's really going on the inside of our being. In our English Bibles, there are several words, at least four words, that are used to describe the inside of us. Of course, we have the word body that describes the outer shell that we give evidence to. You can all see mine, and I'm looking at yours. But inside of us, there's the spirit, there's the soul, there's the mind, there's the heart. These are all words that the scriptures use. Now, in each of these cases, these words can have a profound meaning in their own context, but generally they describe the inside, what's on the inside of us, what really makes up who we are. Now, it turns out that in our own time, I think that some of these words have lost some of their impact, some of their depth of meaning. For example, heart and spirit. We may just say that there was a nice spirit in the meeting today, which means no one was fighting. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean too much. And the word heart is the same way. You know, Tony Bennett left his heart in San Francisco 60 years ago, but he seems to have done very well since that time. I mean, it doesn't seem to have affected his life that much at all. A child can be refused some candy and just be brokenhearted. And then 2 minutes later, when you engage that child in hide-and-go-seek, seems to be laughing and having a good time again. An elementary student can give his heart to 20 other students on Valentine's Day and not even like half of them. I mean, it's just the way it is. So in our culture, I think the word that best describes the inside us, the inner man, is the word soul. We save that word, it seems to me, for our deepest meanings, deeper meaning than we give to the other words. For example, soulmate. A soulmate is a priceless possession. It's someone that you can share your innermost soul with, your innermost being with, without fear of rejection and with complete confidence of confidentiality. If you've never had a soulmate, or if you've lost one, you're the poorer for it. A soulmate is a very special person. We speak of having a dark night of the soul. A dark night of the soul is a time of deep loneliness, of grief, of anguish. And during that time, we actually wonder, life seems in the balance, and we wonder whether we can actually survive. A dark night of the soul is a tragic time to go through. We speak of going through periods of soul searching. A soul searching time is when we do a thorough examination of our innermost thoughts and feelings to determine what do we really believe? What's really going to motivate us and move us forward in life? Then finally, we talk about selling our souls. To sell your soul is to give up on a moral conviction in order to save some other lesser gain in your life. For example, a salesman may highly value his reputation as an honest man his customers can totally trust. And then his boss may command him to lie about his product in some way. If the man chooses to tell that lie, he will have sold his soul for the lesser gain of keeping his job. And some of you may have felt that. You've had to sell your soul, as well, give up something that was innate inside of you, very important to you, in order to get some lesser gain that was more external to life. The soul is the resting place for the deepest, most defining set of attributes and characteristics that we possess. It's the place where we really live. I don't live out here. I live inside here. It's the place where we commune with ourselves. You know, you talk to yourself, right? It's the place where we talk to ourselves. It's the place where life makes up its mind. It's the place where we have our greatest joys and our deepest pains. Perhaps you can remember receiving a sincere compliment from a significant person especially in front of other people. It felt wonderful, didn't it? Now, for example, if a boss or a teacher complimented you in front of your workmates or other students, it really felt good. And you stored that in your soul. That's why you remember it today. It's because you stored that in your soul. It's where you felt it, and you store it there. Perhaps you remember a time when you were deeply criticized, bitterly criticized. You stored that there in your soul as well. So in our soul becomes a repository for a lot of things, experiences in life, things that go on in life. They all get stored there, even if we don't show any evidence for them on the outside. In our soul is something that really makes a difference in our life. Now, I would like to give you my thesis statement for my message this morning. Within our souls, this is my thesis statement, within our souls resides a deep thirst and hunger that we experience a life that is satisfying. Not very complicated, is it? Within our soul resides a deep thirst and hunger that we experience a life that is satisfying. I like to call it a life that works. Now, if that's an expression that's kind of hard for you to understand, let me give you an analogy. We probably all like a car that works, right? The engine, you turn the key and the engine starts. You push on the brakes, it stops the car. You turn on the lights, they work. I mean, that's what a car that works does what it's supposed to do. We want a life that works. We want a life that makes it, that comes together in very significant ways. So there are two corollaries then to this thesis statement that we all have a deep hunger and thirst for a life that really works. The first one is that this hunger and thirst is not a bad thing. In fact, we're designed by God to have souls that are hungry and thirsty. The second corollary, though, is that we are foolish people because we go about seeking to satisfy the hunger and thirst of our soul in bad ways. And that is something we have to try to deal with. Now, let me take some time now to expand upon my thesis statement and the two corollaries that I've made. For starters, we can and often do experience hungers and thirsts that we can also call longings. So sometimes I'll call them longings, sometimes I'll call them hungers and thirsts. We experience them on three different levels. The first level we experience them on it would be the level of our circumstances. On the level of our circumstances, these are things that go on around us that don't require anybody else to be involved, really. It's just our circumstances. It's like the weather. You can talk about it, but nobody can do anything about it. I mean, no, it's not. You can't blame any particular person here, even if you have a weatherman here. You can't blame that person for the weather. The economy, I mean, the larger economy, your state economy, the federal economy, the government, the world economy. You can't just point your finger at any particular person and blame them, or at least no one that's in your circle of relationships. It's just the circumstance you find yourself in. You don't like the economy, it's just the circumstance you find yourself in. We'd like to have circumstances in life that are pain-free. We'd like to have a life that works that's pain-free, right? So we don't like pain in our finances. We don't like pain in our school or in our job or in our health. We don't like it when spring doesn't come on time. We don't like it when our team loses. I should tell you that I'm a graduate of Wichita State University, and we made it to the Final Four, but we lost. I did not like it. We don't like it when we get a bad report on a medical test. We don't like it when the repair bill on the car is over $50. In fact, we just don't like bad circumstances. When things are going well, we're likely to say, life is good. Life is good. The second level, after you think of your circumstance, the second level of longings has to do with personal relationships. And now, of course, it does require the cooperation of other people. When you talk about relationships, we'd like a life that works where our relationships are pain-free, if possible. We don't like pain in our relationships. We long to be treated as worthwhile, significant persons. We dread the thought that those people with whom we must interact might think of us as actually unnecessary persons offering nothing as we take up space in their presence. We just don't want to be treated like that. We don't want to be treated as big zeros. We want to be wanted. We want to be needed. We want to be able to make a difference. We want our ideas to count for something. We want to feel like we are significant in the world in which we live. We hope that our boss or our teacher will like our work, will give us a raise, give us a good grade. We hope our parents will approve of our choices and not hassle us. We hope our children will be compliant, they'll stay close to us as they grow older, and we hope that our children will complete their education and then get good jobs and support us in our old age. That's the way it ought to work. In short, we detest the idea that life might not work for us and that others might think of us as worthless or that they might abandon us because in their eyes, we really don't matter. And some of you might really have had some of those feelings in life. I really don't matter to anyone. If both our circumstances and our personal relationships are going well, we're likely to say, life is very good. Yeah. Somebody says, how are you doing? Oh, life's great. Life's very good. Everything's coming up roses. The third area, after you talk about circumstances and personal relationships, is our relationship with God. We may not be as aware of our longings for a relationship with God as we are our longings for circumstances that work out well or that our personal relationships work out well. But we were designed by God to live in relationship with Him. Without Him, the pieces of the puzzle of life never fit together, never give you an integrated whole. He has to be included for the puzzle of life to make any sense at all or for there to be any hope at all. I constantly am amazed at people who do not have God as part of their worldview, how they can deal with circumstances and personal relationships, how they ever get it put together, I don't know. I don't think they do. Now, without him, who would we turn to when we need answers to the really big questions of life? These are the questions that you probably don't ask yourself when things are really going well. We just got a raise, when you just won the golf game, whatever it is. These are not questions you probably ask, but when things are going more difficult, we tend to ask questions like, where did I come from anyway? Where am I going? What's my purpose in life? Why am I here? Why do I do what I do? Just get up and go to work and get a paycheck and come home and watch some TV and go to sleep and get up and do the whole thing. What's it all about anyway? Without God, there's not much of an answer that you can give to that little story. Without him, who will you turn to when you lose your only soulmate? What will you do when the doctor says, I'm sorry, there just is nothing more we can do? Where will you turn when you really need forgiveness for the thoughts and attitudes that have been resident within your soul, but there's no one qualified to give it? You really didn't hurt another person as such. It's just attitudes of bitterness that are within you. Who do you turn to ask for forgiveness? Who do you give thanks to on Thanksgiving Day without God? If we survive long enough, eventually everyone we've counted on will leave us. We need someone who we can count on to always be there for us. We need someone who is absolute, who needs nothing, but always has the resources to meet us in our deepest needs. Jesus acknowledged that hunger and thirst of the soul are appropriate when he said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. He tells us that he's the one who can and will, if we allow him, give us value, meaning, and purpose for our lives. So let's review briefly. Fulfillment of our longings, our hungers, our thirst in relationship to our circumstances doesn't require another person. It's just the way things are. The longings and thirsts, the hungers that we have in relationship to personal relationships on earth here require other finite people like us. And then finally, the longings and thirsts we have at our deepest level, our unseen needs, they require an infinite person to meet. Now, can we be honest with each other? Of which of these three levels are we most aware? Which of these three levels gets the most attention from us? Okay, I'll volunteer. I'll be first. Then I'll start going down the aisles and we can ask everyone to respond to this. My health, I know you're admiring my physique and all, but I exercise. I watch my diet. My wife watches it, actually. But I'm careful about my diet. I'm concerned about my financial well-being. I balance my checkbook every month. Fred, where are you? I balance my checkbook every month. I'm concerned about how much rain we get. I'm a farm boy. You know, a lot of people complain about when it rains. Well, now in Chicago, we've had too much rain recently. Had a lot of flooding. That's a problem. But normally, I'm looking for rain because I'm thinking, how will we eat if we don't get rain? How will the grass turn green? I'm concerned about my sports teams. I know you're Packer fans up here. You're concerned about your sports teams. So circumstances in life are important to me. On the personal relationship side, they also get a high amount of attention from me. I really like to be liked. Is that unusual? I don't really like for people not to like me. I like it when my wife bakes a pie for me. I think when she does, I think maybe she likes me. I mean, it's a good sign. But I don't appreciate it when people wave me off as being meaningless or valueless. I care about my relationship with my children and my grandchildren, all they have to do is suggest a need, and I'm going to be there, even though they live miles from us, because they matter to me. My relationship with God doesn't come quite so naturally. How about you? It seems more theoretical and less practical. You know, I took care of the eternal stuff when I accepted Jesus as my Savior. And since that time, I believe he'll take care of me when I die. You know, he'll take me to heaven. But now is my time. And this is the time when I have to find a way to make my life work for me. This is my time. Consequently, without intentionality, my present relationship with God would get little or no attention in my life. Going to church somewhat regularly and occasionally putting something in the offering would probably be enough to satisfy my felt needs at the God level, the spiritual hunger and thirst of my soul. It'd be enough. However, Monday through Saturday, I would likely have little sense of a real relationship or communion with God, little sense that he is vital or meaningful in my life. Actually, when both my circumstances and my personal earthly relationships are going well, I am most likely to be quite content without giving God a second thought. Parenthetically, maybe that's why he doesn't allow all of my circumstances and all of my personal relationships to just go peachy clean. Maybe that's it. In our hearts, we know that our relationship with God should actually be the primary relationship, and that's the relationship that should inform, influence, and control the attitudes and the thoughts of our soul. It's the thing that should control the other two levels. It's my relationship to God should color my circumstances, how I view my circumstances. It's my relationship with God that should color how I see my personal relationships and affect them, how I treat other people. Unfortunately, we really like to be independent. That's part of our fallenness. We like to make our own decisions. And even if we give a little wink to God by saying, help me, we really like to make our own decisions, but we're not as smart as we think we are, and we end up shooting ourselves in the foot a lot. Right? Now, before I get too lonely up here, because you all look so put together, I need to know if I am alone. Do any of you ever feel that life is so filled with other stuff, duties, concerns, that there really is little or no space for God? A little raising of an eyebrow here would be helpful. Do you ever get honest enough with yourself to admit that your soul is out of touch with God, that God seems distant, that your soul feels empty in terms of God, that you feel barren, dry? Does that ever happen in your life? Do you ever feel that your life is out of control and you have no idea how to get it back under control? Do you ever do things that you know in your heart of hearts that are really wrong, but you do them anyway and you don't know why, and you can't stop? When these conditions are present, they are sure evidence that there's something not right in our soul. We may be looking at our circumstances and blaming our circumstances. We may be looking at our personal relationships and complaining about those. But the problem is in the soul. So let's return to the story in John 5. Here we find a man who, his life has not been working for 38 years. Neither his circumstances in life, obviously, he finds himself in a lame condition, unable to walk, nor his personal relationships, as we gather from the full story, are very satisfying. He's not doing well on either of those two levels. We find him lying on a mat by a pool of water because it was the prevailing thought that these waters were stirred occasionally, and the first one who got into the water after they were stirred would be healed. This man is not the only one by the pool, by the way. There are others who are waiting as well. Their ailments range from blindness to paralysis. To say the least, these were needy, if not desperate folk. Likely they had tried everything, and this was their last resort, their only hope. When Jesus comes into the area of the pool, he does not appear to have done a mass healing campaign. Rather, his eyes were fixed on this one lame man, likely because Jesus had already looked into his soul and realized that his physical condition was the direct result of sin that had taken up residency within his soul. Like I said, perhaps a settled disposition of sinfulness. So Jesus was the first to speak. He says to the man, "Do you want to get well?" Strange question, right? Do you want to get well? From one point of view, this question may have been totally appropriate. Perhaps the man had come to terms with his condition and was at the pool for no other reason than other people expected him to. He had tried everything else. This was the only thing that some people had heard could work. So he's there for no other reason than other people expected him to be there. And so he's lying by the pool, hoping for the waters to be stirred, but he has no confidence that he will ever walk again. No anticipation that he will ever walk again. Maybe it's a little bit like someone who comes to church without any expectation of anything ever really happening there that'll be life-changing. Just coming because somebody else expects you to be here. This man may have been there for that very reason. On the other hand, the crippled man may well have thought that Jesus' question was very odd. The man doesn't know the identity of this man, Jesus. He doesn't know that this man can look right into his soul and see what's going on there. And so he may well have thought, would I be lying here by this pool if I didn't want to get well? Why do you ask such a strange question? So he basically assumes that his presence by the pool makes it obvious he wants to get well. So he explains. He says, I have no one to help me. Other people are failing me. When the waters are stirred, while I'm using what little motor skills I have to try to get into the pool, rolling myself around, somebody else always gets in the pool first, and so that's why I'm not well. When he needed other people the most in his personal relationships, they weren't there for him. Consequently, it really wasn't his fault that he remained in his lame condition. Jesus, as usual, cuts right through to the matter, the core of the matter. He doesn't waste time by exposing the man's excuses, nor does he get into the fact that all the people lying by that pool are actually believing in some sort of a superstition. He just says immediately to the man, he gives a command, he says, get up, pick up your mat, and walk. And in response, the man does exactly what Jesus says. He gets up, picks up his mat, and walks away from the pool. When Jesus saw the healed man a bit later in the temple, he said to him, see, you are well again. And then Jesus gave a second command. First command was get up and start walking. And the second command is stop sinning or something worse may happen to you. In other words, stop doing something that has been harming you and start doing something that would be helpful. Stop the sin that has made you lame so that you can begin to walk as you were intended. Of course, what Jesus was really concerned about was what was going on in the man's soul. In this case, his bodily condition was just a reflection of what was going on in his soul. For us, the condition of our soul might not be lameness. The evidence of the condition of our soul might not be lameness, but maybe for us, it's something else. Maybe it is broken relationships. Maybe it is worry. Maybe it is bitterness. But what's in our soul does produce an effect. The way Jesus interacts with this man is very typical for the way in which he interacts with a lot of people. And so I want to look at two stories briefly, one just before John 5 and one just after John 5, to illustrate how Jesus really looks at people and deals with them. The story in John 4 is the first story. There Jesus meets a woman by the town well of Samaria, the town of Samaria called Sychar. And as Jesus was resting by the well near noontime, a woman of questionable reputation comes to the well to draw water. There were numerous social, ethnic, and gender reasons why it would have been culturally prudent for Jesus simply to have ignored her, not even to let his eyes meet hers. Instead, as with the man laying by the pool in Jerusalem, Jesus initiates a conversation by asking this question. He says to the woman, "Will you give me a drink?" Given their huge ethnic and gender differences, the woman was shocked that Jesus spoke to her at all, and even more shocked that he asked her to draw water from the well in order to give him a drink out of that well. When she voiced her amazement that Jesus would ask her for a drink, Jesus told her, he said, "If you knew who I am, you would have asked me for a drink, and I would have given you living water." The woman is very perplexed. She said to Jesus, "Sir, you have nothing to draw with. You have no bucket. And the well is deep. Where are you going to get this living water?" The woman could only interpret Jesus' question by using physical dimensions. She thinks Jesus is referring to some kind of physical water, which, if drunk, would eliminate her need to continue making her daily trips to the well to get water. So Jesus clarifies. He says, "I tell you, everyone who drinks of this well, this town well, will continue to be thirsty on a regular basis. However, whoever drinks of the water that I am offering you will never thirst again. In fact, that water will become within the person who drinks it a well of water springing up into eternal life. It'll be a spring that will give life forever, for now and forever." So Jesus is not addressing the woman's physical thirst, but the thirst of her soul. That thirst could only be satisfied by the living water that he alone could provide. In fact, Jesus himself is the living water that will satisfy the thirst of the soul. The second story is in John 6, directly following John 5. In John 6, Jesus is being followed by a large crowd of people who are impressed by his miracles of healing. So after Jesus had spent a whole day with these people, it got past the evening mealtime, and the crowd had nothing to eat. So Jesus took 5 small loaves and 2 small fish, gave thanks to the Father, then distributed the loaves and fish to the crowd. The crowd of over 5,000 people were completely satisfied. As the loaves were being dispensed, they just never ran out. The fish never ran out. And there was something left over at the end. To say the least, the crowd was impressed. The next day, the crowd again looked for Jesus, thinking perhaps he would be good for another free meal. Wow. So Jesus confronted them with the fact that they were following him not because of the food that he had given them, but not because of what the food illustrated. Not because of what it symbolized. He himself is the bread of life that, if ingested, would completely satisfy the innermost being, their soul. They shouldn't be looking for him to provide them with tangible physical food as much as the food that would satisfy the soul. The point of both of these stories is that Jesus had not only come to give life, but that he himself is the life he came to give. After all, he is the way, the truth, and the life, and nobody comes to the Father but by him. And so without him, no one desirous of a full and meaningful life can ever find it. In order to have that, we must take Jesus into our innermost being. He must so fully possess us that he begins to live out his life in us. To make his language as vivid as possible, this whole idea of you've got to take me into your innermost being. In order to make that language as vivid as possible, Jesus told the crowd, "Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can have no life in you." Unfortunately, people in Jesus' own day, as well as in later periods, have taken Jesus in a very literal fashion, such that they believe that in communion, they actually physically eat the body of Jesus and drink his blood. I think to take this sort of position is to obviously miss Jesus' main point here. Undoubtedly, Jesus was speaking here about eating his flesh and drinking his blood just the same way as he was speaking to the woman at the well when he said that he would give her living water. And that Jesus should speak this way should not surprise us. After all, we do the same when we speak of devouring books, drinking in lectures, swallowing stories, ruminating on ideas, chewing over a matter, or even eating our own words. I've heard not a few new grandmothers say, I could just eat up my grandbaby. Now, I think that what she is meaning is, I just can't get enough of that child. It isn't that she's just turned into cannibalism. It's not that she's just decided she's just going to start gnawing on babies. We hear sometimes, you are what you eat. This does not mean that if you eat a carrot, you will become a carrot or you'll get red hair. What it does mean is the good qualities of the carrot will become part of you, and it will make a difference in the life that you live. You will have a healthier life. Your soul has been, is now, and will be eating and drinking something. It is hungry, it is thirsty. Like a hungry teenage boy, your soul will find something to eat. And unfortunately, if you do not make sure that it's eating healthy food, it will find junk food. The devil is looking for any weakness he can find within my soul and yours. Are we easy prey for him? Do you walk around with your mouth wide open, allowing him to throw into your mouth whatever he wants? I know that's a very graphic metaphor. But the truth is that the devil is always ready to put images in front of us that look like perfectly good food and drink. He sells the idea that eating and drinking what he offers will bring us the greatest satisfaction, but the devil's promises are always, always, always a lie. His goal is to steal, to kill, and to destroy. He is seeking those that will eat his line, drink his lie, in order to destroy their spiritual health and eventually their very life. And we can so easily be tricked by him. In the world in which we live today, there are well over a billion people who do not have access to clean drinking water. They have no option but to drink dirty, disease-ridden water. Illnesses in these places are rampant. Thankfully, there are today numerous agencies and ministries, including international teams, that are drilling boreholes, putting in pumps, and providing pure drinking water for these people. But wouldn't it be disgusting if after making a borehole, putting in a shaft, putting in a pump, and providing clean drinking water for these people, if they went back once again to drinking from the same polluted streams that they'd been drinking from before, the same ones that are filled with sewage water, wouldn't it be disgusting on the spiritual plane? Is that what some of us are doing? Are we walking right past the fountain of living water and drinking from sources that are contaminated by the devil and the world's values? Perhaps while I've been speaking, you've been doing a little evaluation of what's in your soul. I suspect a lot more needs to be done, but perhaps you've started. Is it obvious to you that even though no one else may know it, you've played the game pretty well, you've looked right, you've done the right things, that there's something not quite right in your soul? Have all your efforts to find peace and joy and a purpose bigger than yourself and your appetites simply failed? This morning, Jesus is looking right at us. We're the people by the pool this morning. And he's looking right at us. He's looking right at you and right at me. And he's saying, do you want to be well? Do you want to be free? Do you want to be clean? Do you want to be healthy? Do you want to be whole? Do you really? Some of us may have to be honest and say, thanks, but no thanks. I am committed to the kind of life I've been living. I'm happy with hypocrisy, putting on a front. I'm going to continue just where I am. As we move into a new week, perhaps there are others of you who will say, you know what, I'm going to choose to begin walking in another different direction. Each of us will choose during this new week what we will feast on, what we will drink, what we will eat from a spiritual point of view, what we will feed our souls on. Unless you do something intentional to change the course of your life, your next week will look pretty much like last week and the week before that. Unless you stop waiting on other people to fix your problems and begin opening yourself up to the one who is the fixer of all problems, nothing's probably going to change. As you walk into a new week, let's together invite Jesus to walk beside us as our companion. Remember that old song, "Take the Name of Jesus With You"? It didn't just mean make a little placard and hang it on yourself that says Jesus. It means take Jesus. The name means what he stands for. Take Jesus with you into those meetings, into those relationships. Take Jesus with you. Ask him to look into your soul. Ask him to tell you what he sees there. And if he reveals some junk, ask him for the strength to pitch it. Spend time talking to Jesus. He's the lover of your soul. He wants to give you a full God-honoring life. In fact, he says, without me, you can do nothing meaningful. So, in closing, just remember this. You can't quench your thirst drinking muddy water, dirty water. You can't even cleanse your soul by going to a dirty stream. But there's good news. There is a well where the water is clean. There's only one, but there is a well where the water is clean. And we need to be going to the well that never will run dry in order to drink. That's where life comes to its fullness. When he invades our life, we begin to live the life that God intends for us to live. As long as we hold him at some distance, we're always living a lie and a sham. He wants to come in. The Lord speaks through Isaiah, and he says, "Come, all you who are thirsty, come to the waters, and you who have no money, come, buy and eat. Come buy wine and milk without money and without cost. Why spend money on what is not bread, and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen to me, and eat what is good, and you will delight in the richest fare. Give ear and come to me. Listen that your soul may live." And then Isaiah the prophet adds this instruction. He says, "Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake their ways and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them turn to the Lord, and he will have mercy on them, and to our God, and he will pardon." Here's my testimony. All my life, I've had a thirst for some drink from some clear spring that I hoped would quench the burning of the thirst I felt within. Feeding on the husks around me till my strength was almost gone, longed my soul for something better, only still to hunger on. Praise God. Finally, I have found him. Hallelujah. I have found him whom my soul so long has craved. Jesus satisfies my longings. Through his blood, I now am saved.